You're listening to the cycling podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freeb.
Hello, Rich.
And we're joined once again by Francois Tomazo.
Hi there.
For a second and final time, because you're off tomorrow, Francois.
Yes, I'm going to the to Canada next week for the Quebec and Montreal Grand Prix. So, my last day here on the Vuelta.
Excellent. Well, it's my last night in the Vuelta as well. I head off tomorrow handing the baton over to Lionel Burney. Speaking of whom, he has his tale of the etapa. Over to you, Lionel.
Stage 12 to the Basque city of Bilbao saw Belgium's Jens Kuchelaer land Orica Bike Exchange's second stage win of the Vuelta. It was a relatively quiet day for the GC contenders, but there was plenty of aggression from riders sensing an opportunity to win a stage, simply because the stage didn't finish up a great big hill. The first break got away on the first category, Puerto de Alisas, in the first 50 kilometres, and it contained a few handy riders, including former race leader Darwin Atapuma, Gianluca Brambilla, Louis Menkes, Kenny Elissonde, Roman Hardy, and two of Chris Froome's teammates, Peter Kennock and David Lopez. Atapuma crashed on the descent of the climb and dropped back to the bunch, and the rest of the break pressed on without him. The final 50 kilometres took the riders over the Alto Vivero twice, and the break was brought back in on the first descent of that climb. Second time up, Dries De Venins of I Am Cycling went clear on his own. There was a short-lived counter-attack behind him, and Alberto Contador also tried something, but to no avail. De Venins had 30 seconds lead going over the top of the climb, and he gave it absolutely everything on the run-in, but he was fighting a losing battle and was caught with around 2 kilometres to go. It was a bit scrappy for a while as several riders tried to get away going into the final kilometre, and with the finish looming in the wide straight in Bilbao, Kuchelaer went for a long sprint but timed it to perfection and had the power to get over the line ahead of Maxime Bouet and Fabio Fellini. Kuchelaer bagged the biggest win of his career and made it 2 stages for Orica after Simon Yates' win last week. No change overall. Nairo Quintana still leads overall, as well as holding the mountains and combined classification leads. Alejandro Valverde leads on points, and I'll be in Spain this time tomorrow.
Yes, thank you, Lionel. We're here in Bilbao. We're in the Basque Country, the cycling heartland. We've featured the Basque Country quite a bit in the podcast. I did a little Basque Country report last October with interviews with Jaime Zubeldia and Markel Irizar, among others, and Markel Irizar, who sadly is not far from here recovering. His face was in a right state after a nasty crash where he lost a few teeth earlier last week. And then also we did a special report from the Tour of the Basque Country earlier this year. It's a fascinating region. It's very mountainous, you know, very steep climbs here, very green. It does get a lot of rain here, and the weather's very strange. It can be, you know, 15 degrees in July and 25 degrees in December. It's a strange place in terms of the climate. And we saw a good stage. I'm not going to say it's a cracker. I always say that, and Daniel tells me off. But it was a good stage, an interesting stage. Surprising to see two Team Sky riders in the breakaway. What, you spoke to Chris Froome at the finish, Daniel. What was his verdict? He had Peter Kennock, and we'll talk a bit about him maybe later on, and David Lopez, local boy.
Well, Chris Froome simply said that those two riders, Pete Kenyuk and David Lopez, didn't have too much to do today. And this is the difference. We talk a lot about the pressure, the burden of having the leader's jersey. And Froome said that when you're second in general classification, your domestiques do have a lot more freedom. And we've seen Kenyuk go down the road a few times. We've speculated as to whether this might be part of Sky's new, you know, these efforts to introduce a slightly more, well, attacking style of racing that we saw in the Tour de France. Today, I think it was simply a case, as Froome said, of Kenyuk and Lopez otherwise being a bit redundant. And of course, Lopez was on home roads.
Well, I spoke to Dario Cioni, the sports director at Team Sky, at the finish briefly, just to ask him those same questions. And here he is, Dario Cioni. Dario, that's something we're not used to seeing. A couple of Team Sky riders in the break when you've got, obviously, overall ambitions here. What was the thinking there?
I think maybe we didn't expect to have two riders, but more one. I think when the break went, Pete was up there, and the break happened behind him. So once he was in the break, more or less it was the same effort at the front on that climb or chasing behind. The idea was to keep the pressure on Movistar. They liked the team classification and were looking to enter a break.
So there wasn't a fear that Chris would be left exposed at all, because Kennick has obviously been a strong ally for him in the climbs, especially so as Lopez.
No, it was more of a move to put the pressure on, and then a bit unlucky for us that Astana relieved Movistar from the chase in the last 50k. Obviously they had a plan, and if it had been two or three guys more in the break, possibly it would have been ideal.
Can we expect to see more of that then?
Who knows?
So yeah, Dario had a bit of a glint in his eye. I think they enjoyed having two riders up the road. He suggested that had there been another couple of riders there, the breakaway might have stood a chance. I think they were also handicapped by the loss of Darwin Atapuma, your friend Daniel. You're a big fan of Darwin Atapuma, who had a terrible crash on the front on the descent. He went down very heavily, did really well to finish the stage more or less with the bunch, but they probably missed his firepower in the break. He's a good man I'll say that. Of course, Joe Dombrowski would disagree, but he's quite a strong rider in a break, isn't he? Potentially.
Yeah, he can be, and I think generally what we're hearing at the moment on the Vuelta is that the lack of sprint stages and the lack of sprinters and sprint teams is really making this a very hard Vuelta, together with the course as well. And the course does lend itself to opportunists attacking riders. And there are so many guys here who are riding for a contract or who are riding for World Tour points. Let's not forget that. We don't talk about it very often. Dimension Data is a good example of a team which desperately needs World Tour points. And it really changes the complexion of the whole race when there are no sprinters. Everyone knows that it's going to be a huge fight to get in the break, and it's not going to be the same kind of fight that it is to get in a break when the sprinters are here. On those occasions, in those circumstances, the race tends to calm down very quickly once the break has gone. Here, I think there's a little bit more of a fight, a prolonged fight. And it's not necessarily given that the break is going to go in the first hour, and that's going to be the only break we'll see of the day. We've seen instances this week of breaks going in the last hour of the race.
Yeah, I think it's been actually one of the talk of the first 2 weeks, this absence of sprinters. And the funny thing is that some guys, reveal themselves as sprinters. Alejandro Valverde, revealed himself as a very, very good sprinter. I mean, we knew he was, from the past. But in these kind of stages without, the sprinters team controlling, I'm not saying everybody's a chance, but lots of guys have a chance. And Jens Kukula today had his chance to get back quickly to the two Team Sky riders in the break. I mean, I heard a quote by David Lopez, who said that the plan apparently also was to force Movistar to work at the back. It was a way to unsettle them a little bit. Fair enough. And because actually one thing that struck me is that neither Kennock or Lopez were very active in they didn't take many turns in the break, so maybe they were there a little bit by chance, and maybe actually the idea was really to upset Movistar.
And I should have said, but you've not heard the Darcin interview, but he said that was part of the strategy, maybe also to keep Peter Kennock happy, because he's a guy who probably wants his own chances as well. This was a day that where he could be given a little bit of rope, and I mean, this is part of my charm offensive to Peter Kennock a little bit, because we've upset him today, haven't we?
Or
haven't I upset him? Haven't I?
Well, just nothing to do with me.
Just to explain, I spoke to Peter Kennock yesterday at the start and asked if he'd do an interview. He said, "Yeah, no problem." And then he said, "Is it for the podcast?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, I don't want to do it then. I don't want to speak to podcasts. I don't like them." So we chatted a bit. It was all very good natured. He explained his reasons. I mean, he's worried, I think, that he does tend to speak his mind. And often when he speaks his mind, he gets a lot of flack for it. And you don't always necessarily agree with what he says, but it's refreshing that a rider does speak his mind. And, in certain media, i.e. Twitter or in print, sometimes his comments can be more easily misconstrued. And my point to him was that in audio, we would just play what he said and not chop it up or edit it, or so it would be his own words, his own voice. But I could tell it was going to take a while, and I think it might have dynamited any possibility of an interview with Kennick on the podcast, because he refused at the finish of the day to speak to the podcast. So
I'm having nothing to do with this.
Do you think it's of Peter's own decision not to speak to the podcast?
It's certainly his own decision, yeah.
Because in the I have found in the last couple of months and years, you know, that Team Sky's PR policy or relationship with the press has changed a little bit, and you've always got the impression they all start talking the same. There's always a press officer not too far from you, you know, trying to look and listen to what you're saying, and maybe Kennick is not, you know, within this frame, and so maybe that's the reason why. Maybe he's been told, you know, well, you're a little bit too outspoken, and you should. Care a bit much,
I don't know. I
more.
Think I suspect that some of the things he said have landed him in hot water. But I'm pretty sure, I'm 100% sure that it's not a team directive at all. I mean, you know, a guy like Ian Boswell, who's his roommate, this might not help. But he came and did our Facebook Live with us the other day. It was an interesting moment in the press conference with Chris Froome when you asked a question, Francois, and Chris requested that you introduce yourself. Now, to explain, that there was a distance there because you were down in the press center, so he maybe couldn't see who was asking the question, but it was a bit of an odd moment.
It was an odd moment. I can understand it, because it's true that from time to time it's the polite thing to do to introduce yourself. But this is the Vuelta. There aren't that many journalists, and usually you just, you know, ask your question. And there were other questions asked from the press room by other people who didn't have to introduce themselves. So, well, maybe Chris is listening to the podcast and recognized my voice, and I wanted to make sure it was a podcast. I don't know. That's just a thought.
You say that, Francois, that it's the polite thing to do, but I always find that a bit unsettling. Settling when you're required to identify yourself as though someone somewhere is watching.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for sponsoring the cycling podcast. Of course, they're showing the Vuelta every day live. Now, there was a stage victory today for Jens Kukeler, Orica Bike Exchange rider, 27 years old. Now, he was very impressive in the press conference, wasn't he? A very, very, very good speaker. Not a guy I know a great deal about. He's 27 years old. He's been at Orica Bike Exchange for a long time now. Highly rated, I believe. We did hear from him at the finish. Also, Neil Stevens, his sports director at Orica Bike Exchange. I spoke to him at the finish. Let's hear first from Neil Stevens, and then we'll hear from Jens Kukeler. Sage win today, then. Did you see that one coming?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I sort of had a bit of an inkling, you know. Jens has been in great shape all through the race, but over the last couple of days, he's really, the rest day was really good, quite good for him. He's a guy who really loves doing his work, and he's quite quick as well. I knew from the past, from the Tour of the Basque Country, the finish would be a reduced bunch. And I said, look, first do your work, and let's try to do it efficiently, and if you can, give it a crack in the finish, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's been with the team a long time. This has got to be his biggest victory.
Yeah, I'd reckon so. I don't know his statistics, but I reckon it would be about his biggest win. And it's personally, I think it's even bigger to know that he's been working every day of the Vuelta up until now. He even worked during the stage today. At 20 kilometres ago, he was the one that came back and got Simon Yates, took it up to the front and that sort of stuff. So it's more than just a win. It's a sum up of the characteristics of Jens as a worker.
Simon was on the attack, Simon Yates, towards the finish again today. We obviously saw Chavez on the attack yesterday. Are GC ambitions still there, or are stage wins sort of assuming a greater importance now?
GC ambitions have been a great importance right from the start. Stage wins are a bit of an icing on the cake. What we're here for is GC. Once again, I'll go back and say that the Simon Yates covering the brakes at the final it sums up the ambience in the team. That wasn't his job. He's here to do GC, but he knew that Jens wanted to give it a crack today. He knew that he needed a bit of someone to cover the brakes, and he was good enough and kind enough to be able to do that.
Simon's obviously riding really well. I think after Adam's performance at the Tour, it was kind of expected, but how impressed have you been, and are you with how he's riding this Vuelta?
I'm really impressed by his character. I'm really impressed by his mature attitude. And obviously it's by his sporting performance. I dare to argue that it's anything to do with Adam or his performances. I think that's just what it is.
So that was Neil Stevens. I then asked Kukeler in the press conference about the what Neil Stevens said about him looking after Simon Yates really quite late on in the stage and yet still having the legs to win the sprint. I also asked him whether he was surprised, given that he went so early, he went with about 300 metres to go, that nobody came round him in the sprint.
I think we didn't really commit after that last climb to make everything come back together for a bunch sprint. But we did say in the meeting this morning, if I was still there, that I could give it a go, but we weren't going to sacrifice the team to control everything and bring it back to a sprint. I'm really happy that it eventually did all come back together. But it wasn't up to us to control the race.
The Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa.
So that was Jens Kuchler. It was, he did go from a long way out, didn't he? And I don't know, it was an odd one. I expected him to be overwhelmed, but maybe that's again another sign of how few top sprinters there are in the race.
Yeah, I think he's typical of those riders who have really almost fallen between two stools in their careers. He I think had a period where he didn't know whether he was a sprinter or a classics rider, and the fact that he's Belgian might have influenced his decision, as I think it does with a lot of that kind of rider, fast riders who have the potential to go well in Flanders and these races. And you know, it's quite irresistible, I think, for a lot of them, that the kind of attention and the coverage that those races get, it's quite hard to resist. And he seems to have become much more of a classics rider than a sprinter. But also, you know, just you look at that group and you look at how few sort of fast riders are in this Vuelta generally, and you wonder how much the team managers or whoever picked the various teams for this Vuelta knew about who else was coming. And you kind of feel that if everyone was aware of the riders that every other team was bringing, there was some low-hanging fruit to be had here. There was some real opportunities for someone to come here and pick up three or four stage wins. And, you know, Jani Meersman, I'm sure if you told Jani Meersman a month ago that he was going to be the fastest man in the world, which, to be honest, he has been the fastest man, he probably would have been quite surprised by that. But again, it's a difficult thing to coordinate, isn't it? Because although riders might get their race programs at the start of the year and you might be able to draw up a provisional list of who's going to be at the Vuelta, only takes one faster guy or two faster guys to be thrown in at the last minute, and suddenly your fast guy is no longer that much of an asset.
Yeah, that's the charm of the Vuelta as well. You know, you suddenly you discover or you rediscover that guys are not cycling these days with the Tour de France or the big classics or most of the World Tour races, and in the teams, riders are you know assigned to a precise role for most of the season and sometimes for most of their careers. When they started or whatever in the amateur ranks or the young riders, they had sprinting qualities. They might have had climbing qualities, and sometimes all this is sacrificed for the sake of the team and for the big scheme of the World Tour. And what we're discovering, Maxime Bouet came second today. Who knew that Maxime Bouet could sprint? Well, he doesn't know it himself because he said at the finish, you know, had I trust in myself, if I had enough self-confidence, I might have won that. But I just went for a podium place. And then I realized, oh, bloody hell, I could have won it, you know. And so all these guys all of a sudden find themselves surprised to finish, you know, in a good position. The other thing is we're coming to a stage in the world where everybody's tired. And so almost anything can happen. Look, normally Christian Sbaraglia, the Italian sprinter for the Dimension Data, who won a stage last year, he should have been the fastest sprinter in the field there, even faster than Kukulera. He was what, fourth or fifth? Fifth, I think. And so fourth. Yeah, so you know, it also goes to show that at this stage in the Vuelta, with the few chances left, well, almost everybody's got a chance.
So who's going to win tomorrow, Francois? It's another difficult one to call tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely no idea. No, for once, I'm not even going to try. I don't know.
I, and probably a lot of other people, were disappointed that Peyo Bilbao of Caio Ruralt didn't win, because surely that would have been the first ever winner of an eponymous city in a Grand Tour.
What a challenge.
Surely.
What a challenge.
That, I mean, this is going to be all over the Twitter sphere, you know, to try to find if one day a guy won a stage in an eponymous...
Can you think of anyone who could have...
Irish Peloton. Killian's got to know, hasn't he?
But can you think of anyone? Can you think of anyone who was named after or whose surname was a city who might have possibly had a chance? I couldn't.
Well, you've probably had longer to think about this, Daniel, than us. Yeah. I think you've really put us on the spot here.
Well, you know, as we said, as we discussed between us and on Twitter, there's quite a few little villages called Quintana in Spain. So maybe one day, you know, who knows? But and there was a funny thing I noticed, because you pointed out that we went through a little village called Quintana and the day when Quintana won the stage. But I also it reminded me that, you know, 2 days before, when he took the red jersey, we also went through a village called Quintana del Rueda, I think. There's something there.
Did you also spot that a couple of days ago, on the way down from Peña Caparga, we went through a place called Heras?
That's right. And we also went through a place on the very first day, through a place called Reza, which didn't bring any luck to Kevin Reza, who unfortunately had to leave the Welt after a crash.
Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world. See rafa.cc for more information.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast. So, since we've got you here, Francois, as our young French rider, I wanted to ask you about Pierre Latour, riding extremely well. I just looked up where he is. He was quite active the other day on the climb, and he's still pretty well placed overall. He is 17th. Ah, not as high up as I thought he was, but he's been good, and he's only 22 years old. What can you tell us about him?
The funny thing is, almost the first time I heard about Pierre Latour was on the Vuelta last year. I took the plane with Vincent Lavenu, who is the AG2R manager, and he told me, you know, the next big thing in French cycling is Pierre Latour. He's so good, and he even told me that when Latour was 19, one day, you know, he did something that one of these coaches didn't like, and so he was punished for that, and he came to Vincent Lavenu and told him, you know, what this guy did is not good. I was punished, but I shouldn't. And Lavenu told me, well, I was forced to support, you know, my staff, but in the same time, it shows that this guy's got personality, and he told me this guy is the next big thing. And so this year, he came to the Vuelta, and it's very strange. I mean, it's the strategy of the AG2R. Maybe some other teams are trying the same thing. He came as the unofficial leader. What Julien Jourdi, who's the AG2R team director on this race, told me is that they brought Pierre Latour here for him to really go for the GC, to act as a leader, and they want him to get the reflexes of a leader from the youngest possible age, so that he's got the right attitude, the right, you know, he knows exactly how to behave with his teammates and everything. And the plan, Jourdi said, was to do exactly the same they did with Romain Bardet, to bring him, you know, to make him aware from the very start that he's a leader and that he has to act like one.
I think that's probably an important reflex for guys to learn. I mean, Candel are trying a similar thing with Davide Formolo here. I think it's very easy for guys who come here with GC ambitions, as soon as they lose some time on the first mountain stage or second mountain stage, to almost fall back on the option of, oh, well, I'll go for a stage win. And that almost becomes a bit of a comfort blanket for the rest of the race. And it's a completely different mentality, isn't it, from you know, really having to dig in every single day and just limit your losses and just stay focused, stay concentrated. Because I think, you know, that ultimately is the discipline of riding Grand Tours, to keep that focus.
I think also that for somebody like him, Romain Bardet will be very important. This generation, Pinot, Bardet, Barguil, are almost sort of trailblazers in a way. They're showing once again young French riders what can be done after a sort of lost or a couple of lost generations. And it could be the next wave of riders who come through who really do succeed at that level. The story that you tell about him upsetting his coach is very reminiscent of young Greg LeMond and Cyril Guimard, who was very unimpressed but secretly impressed by Le Mans' antics at a race in Brittany, where he lost his temper with the mechanics and threw his bike away. And Guimard, that was the moment where Guimard thought, this guy has got the attitude, the personality that I'll need to control, but which will also carry him a long way.
Yeah, the funny thing is Jordi, the team director here for AG2R, also told me is you were talking about he told me he's childish. You know, Latour is still very childish. Like sometimes you have the impression he's dealing with a 14-year-old. You know, so there's lots of things for him to learn. And the good thing he said, the good thing about him being childish is that if he has a bad day, he doesn't care. You know, the next day is another adventure, another lesson, another thrill. And so he's very fresh. He's learning every day. He's got lots of heart, lots of guts. You know, he goes for it. He never rode more than 10 days in succession in competition before. So, I mean, this guy is... And the fact that Jean-Christophe Perrault, who is an old guy, you know, who was second in the Tour a couple of years ago, is there to, you know, to show him the way, is pretty symbolic of the, you know, passing of the baton between one and the other. Yeah, Latour is obviously one of the French guys to look out for in the future, obviously.
I tried to speak to Kenny Ellison at the finish. He was in the breakaway today. Unfortunately, he was in the douche when I appeared at the Francis de Jeu. But sorry, Daniel, that's shower. But yeah, little Kenny Ellison. He's somebody you've interviewed before, Daniel. He's sort of mercurial, isn't he? He's capable of great things. But you know, I was looking at the FDJ bikes there, and his bike is tiny. He's like a mini Esteban Chavez.
Yeah, when you see him, you almost can't believe he's a professional cyclist. You just wonder how he manages to stick with the peloton on the flat. And you know, the problem he's had numerous problems. One particular problem over the last year been a horrific injury that he had. I remember seeing very grisly pictures on Twitter. That's was right. It a knee injury, Francois?
I think it was, yeah. A knee injury, yeah. That, you know, kept him out of action for a long time, and in the same time, there's another problem with Kenny Ellison, but that's what the FDJ guys say, you know, off the record more or less, is that he usually performs best at the end of the season, or even more so. Well, you were mentioning that before. He most of the time he performs well when his contract is ending. You see what I mean? He's the type of rider who needs that sort of pressure, and maybe the mistake Marc Madiot did in the last couple of years was to make him sign a 2-year contract. He's the kind of riders, I know it sounds a little bit cynical, but maybe some of these riders need that sort of incentive. And so from what I hear, he might have signed a new 1-year contract. And obviously some riders need that flexibility or that precarious edge to go for it, and that's been a problem with Ellison for a lot of time. Well, the injury.
He's almost as cultured as you, Francois, as well. I mean, is that a
he
a
likes his art,
perhaps?
He likes his poetry, he likes his highbrow literature, but he's perfect for the Vuelta, really, or he's proven to be perfect for the Vuelta. He won at the Anglia a couple of years ago, and not the kind of guy. Again, we were talking about guys who can maintain their focus over 3 weeks. He's not someone who can do that, but he can really target.
He can shine on odds.
Yeah,
he
can target stages, and he can be quite a dangerous guy in a breakaway, particularly when a lot of climbing and steep climbing is involved.
Anything else catch your eye, Daniel? Or Francois, I mean, as you prepare to bow out from the Vuelta, what are your sort of thoughts on departure? Who's going to win?
To be honest, I think Quintana is going to win it. Froome looks impressive, but he's always had his bad day on the Vuelta. So I suspect Quintana looks really, really strong. He acts like a winner. He doesn't seem to doubt at all. I don't see him lose any time anywhere except in the time trial. And the time trial will be, we don't know. It's going to be the big, the big game, the big quiz of the end of the Vuelta. Will it be enough? Let's not forget that the day after the time trial, there's another big mountain stage with a steep climb. And so for me, Quintana is the guy. The most interesting thing I heard this morning, and I don't know if it is true, that Quintana apparently, or some guys at Movistar, had questioned the use of power meters and said that that they should be banned. And so I had a little bit of a chat this morning with Leopold Koenig, who says he never uses them in a race, and who said that Chris Froome on those 2 days when he paced and everything, apparently said that with the light of the sun and everything, they just couldn't see what was on the parameters. I don't know if that's right or wrong. But there was an interesting chat I had with Neil Stevens, the Orica Bike Exchange team director, who lives in Spain, and he was telling me what he likes about the Latin riders is that you go to the drawing board and you go with A, B, and C, and the Latin riders always come up with a D, and that's what he likes about Latin riders. And on the opposite, you've got Chris Froome, who paces, who plans his climbs. It's the opposition of two different styles of cycling that make it, that really makes it an interesting race. So we'll see who wins. The parameter Froome, if there is such a thing, I don't think that's entirely right, or the inspiring or
the
improvising
robot against the artist.
Quintana, which is not right either. I don't know, but at least it's interesting in that sense.
Francois, just a question from me. If you could take your Vuelta organizer's red polo shirt off for a minute, and just on the race itself, it's a very appealing. You can't ignore the fact when you're here, particularly. It's very obvious that it's quite synthetic and it's quite sort of confection, but it's a very appealing package what they've done with the world. So we've only been in coastal regions really this year. Short stages, these fantastic, dramatic, steep climbs at the end of races. Relatively short stages. Do you think this is the face of future Grand Tours? Is this the way that Grand Tours ought to go, do you think?
Yes, in many ways I think that's the way it should go. The Tour de France will never go entirely in that kind of direction, because there will always be these longer stages. I mean, I think it's part of the tradition of the Tour that you have long, more than 200k stages. So, but if you look at the courses Christian Prudhomme has designed in the last couple of years, you have more of these, very short and dense and intense shorter stages. I don't think the Tour will ever sacrifice sprinters ever. That's another thing, as we discussed before. We don't have real sprinters here, and that's something that's part of the tradition of the Tour as well. That we won't lose. And the Vuelta is so exciting as well, because it's at the end of the season, and you've got tired guys, you've got different objectives, it makes it a very different race. I think that the interest of the Grand Tours is that they're so different in many ways. You have the fact that the Giro is in spring, the Tour is in July, the Vuelta is now, makes for three monuments that should keep their identity, and that's what makes them exciting.
Each is very different, isn't it? And you mentioned Christian Prudhomme there. It reminds me, Francois, of the revelation the other day that you actually you're a contemporary of Christian Prudhomme. You studied at university together. You studied journalism together.
Yeah, we were in the same grade, the same term. We spend lots of time together, and the funny thing is, I knew Christian from those times, and he had no idea I had an interest in cycling, and I had no idea that he had an interest in cycling. We were studying journalism, drinking beer, and talking about various things, but never, I don't think ever the word cycling came into our discussions.
Would you have thought then that he would go on to have the career he's had?
Never. No, he was really good on the. He was a really good TV guy. He had this presence. That charisma. He was every time there was a camera, not far. His attitude changed, and he had this knack to attract light. All of a sudden. So, which is something I don't have, and he has. But it was a big surprise actually to think that this guy is the director of the Tour de France.
How long do you think he'll stay as the director of the Tour? He seems like he's in for the long haul. He seems like he's in until he's going to be in until
aren't
the bitter end.
They tend to do 30 or 40 years, don't they, directors of the Tour?
Really, I can't see him retired for quite a while. I mean, he's fit. He's young. He's the same age as me, because we're in. So he's 55, 56, so, which is very, very young. No, I really can see him really going on for at least 5 years, and probably more, probably 10. So, because I can't see anybody else behind him, and I think he has a vision, and I don't always agree with his vision, but no, for me, he's the right man at the right place for now.
Great. Well, we should finish things there. I spoke to Tim Kerrison this morning, Chris Froome's coach. That's for a forthcoming Friends special on Bradley Wiggins. It'll be out in December. Spoke to for a long time to Kerrison about Bradley Wiggins and his role in turning him into a Tour winner in 2012. But on Froome, I did ask him, I said, how much longer do you think Chris can keep at this level? You know, he's talked about 5 or 6 years. How long do you think he can keep it going? He said about 10 days. It was a joke. But I think he was genuinely and is genuinely surprised at how well Froome is going. And he said that Froome is actually surprised. So, you know, perhaps, as you say, Francois, there could be a bad day. Because I think he's really unsure of his form here compared to the Tour, where he really does know, you know, his condition and can pretty much tell how he's going to go. So listen, this is my last appearance on the Vuelta podcast. You're off tomorrow, Francois.
Yes, I'm going to Canada next week for the Quebec and Montreal Grand Prix. So, my last day here on the Vuelta.
I don't want to sort of say that those races in Canada are not going to be interesting, but even more interesting that sound that you're comparing at a book festival with British crime writers in Marseille this weekend.
Yeah, that's right. It's just another one of my jobs, you know. There's a book fair. I'm selling a couple of books I've written, including one of yours, Richard, which I translated. It's called Bolt Supremacy. It's pretty good, especially after the Olympics.
It's got a cooler name in French.
Well, Bolt La Supremacy is very different. And and there's a couple of British writers coming to this books festival. It's near Aix-en-Provence, a place called Fuveau. So if you're around, you know, come along. And there are four British writers, and I'm supposed to show them around. And there'll be a couple of debates and signatures and stuff. So yeah.
You've got this second identity, Francois, a writer of books. You've written all kinds of books, have you not?
Yeah, I've written crime novels. I've written what we call bistronomic books.
Had this before, haven't we? I'm sure on the podcast before I've asked you to tell us the difference between a brasserie, a bistro, and something else. There's another one.
And what we call a zinc. Yeah, I wrote a book called Au vrai zinc parisien. It's been translated into English into the authentic bistros of Paris, and I was telling you that I think the last time the bistro in French actually means bar, so a bistro is not necessarily a place where you eat. Brasserie is a big restaurant with lots of people, you know, and a bistro is funny because English changed the French word into something different. It used to be just a bar, and now it's a bar in which you eat. You know that originally bistro means quick. In Russian, and that's there's a very, very strange story. Apparently, the Russians were in Paris at the end of the 19th century, and while they were waiting in Paris in bars, you know, it's happened to all of us. They were saying bistro, bistro, quick, because you know the waiters were too slow, and that's how little by little the word bistro came to mean a bar. You know,
I knew it'd be worth asking him. That.
I sense a kilometer
that's
zero.
That's the best minute of the podcast tonight, without a shadow of a doubt.
I sense a kilometre zero coming on. Now, I'll have to speak to you about that, Francois.
Final note, Richard. Final footnote. I spoke to Oscar Freire this morning. I was very excited about that. Oscar Freire, one of my favourite riders of all time. Unfortunately, no lawnmower stories.
Oh, all that for no lawnmower story. That's a shame. If you want the lawnmower story, listen to last night's podcast. In the meantime, it's farewell from me, from this Vuelta. Hopefully we'll be back next year. Thank you very much for joining us, Francois.
Well, it's always a pleasure to be on the podcast.
As the anti-Peter Kennick here.
yeah, I love it, you know. I want to be on the podcast more.
And thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard.